Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm thrilled to have Dana Spiota. The first thing I needed to learn about Dana Spiota is that her name isn't Dana Spiota. It's Dana Spiota. And similarly, in her books, the reason why this is significant is I think that she names her characters so that readers will have the same difficulty. Is it Mina or Mina? Is it Ada or Ada? Is it Dana or Dana? And I think that you're...
I want to inflict my characters with my own suffering. Yes.
Is that true? I'm curious.
I not consciously, but it does seem I could see why you would say that.
What I love about these books are especially significant books for people who live in Los Angeles because they manage to create a Los Angeles like Los Angeles. It's like an excavation. There's movie Los Angeles, there's music Los Angeles, there's fashion Los Angeles. Within music Los Angeles, there's punk, there's post-punk, there's rock and roll, there are the Doors, and all of it is jammed into those canyons that we live among where the children and grandchildren live of those incredible stars, and they live cheek by jowl with the next generation, so that Los Angeles, in a certain way, is an assemblage of mythological American music, movie, fashion trends. Yes?
Yes. I mean, I when I was growing up, movies and books and music were everything to me, and I think my imagination goes to Los Angeles a lot because I think of it as being sort of the the pop culture epicenter. So it makes sense that, and also I think because the geography is spread out, it feels that there are lots of corners and margins and hidden places. So I never get sick really of writing about Los Angeles.
Yes, it's three novels now. The newest of which is called Stone Arabia. And the first was Lightning Field, the second, Eat the Document, and now Stone Arabia. The books are very mysterious. They often center in Los Angeles and end in small towns in upstate New York.
That's true.
It's like a kind of exile. And, you seem to know that one of the great things about Los Angeles is that everything works here until one day it sputters out. And so there's the feeling that your characters are the victims of their enthusiasms, and they often outlive. What do you do when your favorite band dissolves? What do you do when an idea goes broke? And that is, in a certain way, the history as well, not just of Los Angeles, but of contemporary America, a set of ideas that keep pooping out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's true. And I think that there's a sense of, I think one of the things in Stone Arabia that I was exploring is that you could look at this as a way of talking about America too, that the youthful exuberance and dreams and ambition and excitement and what that looks like 25 years later. How did that work out? And how, and what accommodations have we made and how do we go on from here? And I think, which is definitely seems to be a big theme.
Here we are, Stone Arabia, reading a book whose title we know nothing about until perhaps the last 20 pages of the book. And even then, someone is going to have to make up the connection.
Absolutely.
And the feeling is always I think it's something created in America recently. No matter how central you are to things, you're a little bit outside the joke.
Right.
You miss the punchline wherever you are and whoever you are. In other words, an off-center life.
Mm.
Do you miss the punchline because you're stoned, hard of hearing, not quite standing where you need to be to hear? The book won't tell you, but the writing has this wonderful off-center quality.
Yes.
That I like very, very much. Did you have that from the word go?
I am very interested in what you describe as off-center, and because I feel myself, that's the sort of my project, that's my little corner, that perspective. I had this feeling when I was growing up that everyone was issued instructions except me, and so so I tend to write characters that have that same feeling, I think. And I think in Stone Arabia, I do like to have an open-endedness toward the end of the book because I want it to keep resonating in your head and the connections to be made. And in this book, you have this narrator who seems to that she's going to tell you everything. She's so intimate and she's so hyperverbal that she's going to explain everything to you. And so so to pull away from that and to have you put these pieces together was an interesting risk that I felt was really important to take.
The person speaking to us is a young woman named Denise, Dee Dee. But she's speaking mostly about her brother, Nick. And her brother, after he was betrayed by a damaging rock impresario.
Mysteriously
betrayed. A major label was on the verge of signing up her older brother's band, The Fakes. He was also the head of a band called The Demonics. And the deal fell through. And rather than go through it again and again, he continued to record albums that were just basically for members of his family, eventually only for his sister, really, and his girlfriend and his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And no one has heard these records, but he's written reviews of them. He's done documentaries about their making. He's kept volume after volume of chronicles. And so the big event in Dee Dee's life is her brother's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that happens to younger sisters a lot, first
mm-hmm.
of all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the book is about what she finds to rescue herself from the cave of her brother's disappearance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's true. And I think it's also how she, I mean, we kind of come upon her in this crisis year where there, what has worked the past 25 years is starting to fall apart for all these reasons. And I think she's trying to work her way through that and also what's happening with her mother's memory loss and her own ability to sort of protect herself from all that's the kind of annihilation that she experiences with her inability to draw a line between the outside world and herself. And she's sort of answering back for the first time. She's taking a hold of some of these things and trying to work through it. I think that is mostly what the book's about, yeah.
And memory is the central act of the book. Her brother is inventing his life. Her mother, suffering from Alzheimer's, is forgetting her life. Her daughter is doing documentaries, establishing the footage and mm-hmm. building up from the facts. And our narrator, Denise, it's like she's been robbed of everything. She's been looking on at her brother's ongoing failure, his alcoholism, his fantasy life, and she doesn't really get to live. She gets to support everyone while working in a real estate office as a personal assistant.
Mm-hmm. I think that her relationship with her brother gave her a lot for a long time, and it was mutual in some ways. But I think at this point now, it's starting to be too much for her with all the other responsibilities that she has. And I think that so I think a break has to happen for them. She needs to separate from her brother. And so that is true.
Now, you were around those years from punk to post-punk to new wave to new romantic. And so this is really a book written in that strange LA aftermath.
Right.
Of like a dream gone sour.
Right, the 80s, yeah.
Yeah.
Will we ever recover from the 80s?
And that sense that LA finally had a scene again,
mm-hmm.
a real music scene with groups that might have made it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is very much a novel in which music stands for the Garden of Eden.
Right.
This is the paradise they all want to enter.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think it's complicated because I think music also, I think that in a way, Nick has preserved his integrity and preserved his himself. And Denise hasn't to a certain extent. So I think even though he's sort of in retreat, he's found with his music and with his chronicles about his music, he's found a way to sort of be. He's sort of to be himself in the face of the kind of assaults of the culture, all the things that you're supposed to do. He's managed to avoid that with her help. So I think she's trying to figure out her way to how to preserve herself. And that's part of what the tension is, I think, between the two of them. And music is, I think, represents both, like many things, I think it can offer a sense of engagement and transcendence that goes against the sort of cultural noise that might annihilate you. It could maybe save your life in a way. But on the other hand, the idea of making it or having success and ambition and all those things, again, can lead to heartbreak and disappointment and commerce, of course, and money.
I'm talking to Dana Spiota. The novel is Stone Arabia. It's published by Scribner, and it's a novel in which LA's music scene is presented as a strange world that can lead to the Dream of Eden. It can make you famous. It can make you legendary. It can make you eccentric. It can make you addicted. It can turn you into anything. It spins you out as something other than you are. And so the hero of this novel, Nick, has invented his own private music scene. And it's not going to victimize him because he's invented it.
He's in complete control.
He's in complete control. He's like the novelist.
Exactly. Well, Michael, that's what I was going to say. I relate to that because I think the novelist wants to be in complete control and creates a little world. And Nick is sort of creating a fictional biography of himself in that way. But then, you know, part of the book is interested in response, too. And so, you know, that what you lose, of course, is the response that you get from other people.
Yes, he can only fantasize his audience, and he does. He becomes different rock critics.
Yes.
He receives imaginary fan letters that
yes.
he writes himself. He writes feature articles on himself. Now, yes, control, but also narcissism, huh?
Yes, sure, certainly, absolutely. But I mean, a long, elaborated, obsessive. I mean, do we call it if it's a novel and we publish it, then it's okay. But if we don't publish it and we hide it in a drawer, then it's narcissism, right?
If we hide it in a drawer and we write our own reviews of it,
okay.
and we stage photography
yes,
sessions.
Definitely. Yes, I guess that's true. But some of his reviews are very negative.
Yes.
So he's kind of, in a way, keeping himself, I think he would view it as keeping himself honest because I think every writer, well, maybe I'm just the only crazy one, but you could write your own worst review, but you would never, you don't actually do it, but you could in a way. And so I think it's perverse that he does it, but I think it's also his way of keeping himself honest.
But it's also his way of making sure that every moment of his life, fantasy is operating. And in fact, we come into this book, the 20th album of his series.
Yes.
Has just come out, his solo series. What's it called?
It's called The Ontology of Worth. And he released, he it's 20 volumes, and he's about to release the last. And this is a kind of crazy experimental. I mean, Nick is very much a self-taught person. And one of the things that was fun about writing this character was he was really pulls from all over, and he doesn't worry about being derivative, and he doesn't worry about being cliche. He just can play with all of it, all the rock and roll tropes he wants, all the intellectual interests that he has, and he just can do whatever, have fun with it. And so I think he has a great joy, as you say, in his imagination and in his inventiveness.
The covers are mosaics. Each of them can be put together finally into a big picture.
Of him.
Of him. And the only one who knows this really is his sister. And she's come upon the idea that now that the 20th album is coming out, well, she's not dumb. He's probably going to kill himself tonight after his birthday party when I go home. And she both knows that nothing can stop him and that she has to stop him. So, you know, she's about to play the role she was born for. And she wonders during this book whether she's up to it, except that now he's going to give her a new role. This is the night she's going to discover that all her life she's been a writer.
That's right.
And by page, what, 7 of the book, he's written the first chapter for her. You know, he's written Dee Dee. He's given her something to finish after he's gone. It's a wild, incestuous novel at that point, right?
Right, right. But I think that's amazing that you picked up on that. I mean, I think in a that's exactly right at what you said. I think
How old is he tonight, this night at the beginning of the book? How old will he be?
Well, he just turned 50. We thought that his birthday was going to be the night, but it takes a couple weeks after that. He doesn't do anything that night. And I had this idea from Ray Johnson, the artist, who had orchestrated his own death, his own suicide as part of his art project, essentially. As someone who lives in a world in which everything is the art project, it seemed to me that that would be where I would go with the book. But then I realized that Nick would have it both ways. He could, in the Chronicles, stage his own death, write his own obituary, but he might not do that in real life, whatever real life is.
Whatever real life is for these characters at this point. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Dana Spiota, author most recently of Stone Arabia. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Dana Spiota about her new book, Stone Arabia, the story of family, identity, and fantasy against the backdrop of rock and roll in Los Angeles. Now, what will the outsider who stumbles into Nick's domain, his kingdom, what will that outsider discover there?
Nick would think that person will think this could have been a real career, and this could be true because he's made sure that, like a novelist, that it has internal logic, and he follows the internal logic, and it's accurate, and he's kept the integrity of the object, the chronicles, and he has all the music for it too. So I think that's maybe what he's counting on to a certain extent. He does leave it all behind.
Now, there was an artist, Henry Darger, mm-hmm. who every day of his life in one book wrote down the weather, in another book wrote down the vast story of what happened during the 10 minutes when a cyclone hit an amusement park, and then chronicled through pictures cut out of coloring books and cartoon books and watercolors that he did himself, the history of the Vivian girls.
Right.
Girls with doubly sexed girls. They have penises and vaginas and horns.
Right.
And they are at war and always win, although things often look dire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nick has made as much of a kingdom as Henry Darger, and he's got records that seem to be influenced by everyone. They're a bit of ambient Eno. Who mm-hmm. else? Who else are his influences?
He has a couple different. He has a pop sensibility that he does his pop records, and that's the Fakes. And I think that's a sort of power pop kind of a big star, Badfinger, Beatles kind of band. And the Demonics, I kind of thought of them as being like television, more experimental, a little cutting, more, difficult. And then the Anthology was complete. You can't even describe all the different levels of experimentation that he's brought to it. And some of it isn't, and you want, I mean, I when I was writing it, I think when he writes the liner notes for it, the Anthology, I don't know if he actually achieves all the things he says he does, because it's his liner notes and he can say whatever he wants about it. So we don't really know what that actually sounds like. We hear Denise describing it at certain points. And one of the things I really like talking about is, and this is maybe perverse on my part, but I like to write about music and listening to music in novels. And I like writing about movies and watching movies in novels. It's a sort of exciting, challenging thing for me that seems to come up again and again. And also watching television is in this too. Yeah.
And you're sly. Sometimes you talk about movies or albums that don't exist.
Absolutely.
That
are, you make up the
money. You make up.
And it's the real ones are in there with the made up ones. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The world now is what a person can make it.
Mm-hmm.
Your previous book, Eat the Document, was about private revolution. And now this is a book about making art as a private act.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, not only making art as a private act, I think of Nick as having given his sister a gift. If she wants to take it, she's welcome to become a novelist.
Right. Absolutely. I think it's a way of, these are people who are trying, the enormity of the world is there, and the terms are terrible, right, for all of us. And these are people who are trying to find a way to answer back. They're trying to find a way to preserve their humanness. And I think and Eat the Document, there was a kind of political sense of answering back, response. And in this book, I think art is another way. And I think that is a kind of, I guess I do have this idea, which is, I guess, a little bit romantic, that there is a sense of preservation of self that's essential to identity, that's essential for us to integrity. I still believe that those are things that we strive for, even if it's one failure after another. All these characters fail and fail and fail, and I don't think that means that it isn't worth trying to do this.
Well, they fail. This is heartbreaking because ultimately, now especially, there is no real world out there. There are a lot of private ideas of what the world is or should be, and our access to that world is through social identity networks. There's no place to go in the world to go and find the world. It's what people always said about LA, that it's a string of a zillion communities right next to one another. And we can't even say, as one could during punk and post-punk, it's happening at the Starwood or it's happening at the Whiskey. There's no place it's happening. You know, you go out to look for your life, and it's not waiting there with open arms.
Yes, and I think that, that's one of the reasons why Los Angeles feels I think it's the place to talk about when you are trying to write the kind of fiction that's interested in the culture, because in a sense the whole world's become what Los Angeles is. And we don't have a center, and we are fragmented, and we do have these private worlds. And yet in the face of this, we have to find a way to make meaning, and we have to find a way to make connections. And I think one of the things that the book also posits is family relationships, which – and everything is fraught and everything is complicated. So they are both oppressive but also preserving and affirming. So one of the things I think the book is about is, I think, love, family love, and how that plays out, and generosity towards these – and obligation and responsibility. All those things I think are things that are – that buttress us in the sense of no center, you know?
Well, also, families seem to be people who give us a gift and then disappear. At the beginning of this book, the father comes and gives Nick his first guitar and disappears. At the end of this book, really, Nick has left a chapter of a life for Dee Dee to finish. He realizes that no one had given her her gift. So this sense that Dad gave me a guitar, sister, I'm going to write the first chapter of your book. Here it is. Now go. Stone Arabia.
Exactly. The pencils are sharpened. Everything's ready for you. Yes.
He's left a desk space for her.
Yes.
It's well lit. Now go ahead. In this strange city of Los Angeles, you imagine your world.
Right. Absolutely.
I've been talking with Dana Spiota, author most recently of Stone Arabia, published by Scribner. Thank you for joining me, Dana.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.